Mission checked the coveralls. The ones on top were covered in soot, more grey than white. There were dozens of them stacked in the sorting crate. He remembered all the new hires. It was as if they wanted half the silo dressed in white and the other half fighting one another. It made no sense. Unless the idea was to get everyone killed.
Killed,
Mission said. He splashed down the shelves to another crate. I've got a better idea. He found the right bin. He and Cam had been given one of these just a few days ago. He reached in and pulled out a bag. How would you two like to make some money? Joel and Lynn hurried over to see what he'd found, and Mission held up one of the heavy plastic bags with the bright silver zipper and the hauling straps. 384 chits to divide between you, he promised. Every chit I own, I just need you for one last tandem. The two porters played their lights across the object in his hands. It was a black bag. A black bag made for hauls such as these. Chapter 49. Mission sat on the counter and worked the laces on his half-boots free. They were soaked, his socks as well. He shucked them off to keep the water out of the bag and to save their weight. Always a porter, thinking about weight. Lynn handed him one of the security coveralls, an extra precaution. He wiggled out of his porter blues and tugged the whites on while Lynn looked the other way. His knife he strapped back to his waist. You guys sure you're up for this? He asked. Lynn helped him slide his feet into the bag and worked the inside straps around his ankles. Are you sure? She asked, cinching the straps. Mission laughed, his stomach fluttering with nerves. He stretched out and let them work the top straps under his shoulders. Have you both eaten? We'll be fine, Joel said. Stop worrying. If it gets late, lie your head back, Lynn told him. She worked the zipper up from his feet, and don't talk unless we tell you it's okay. We'll take a break every 20 or so, Joel said. We'll bring you into a bathroom with us. You can stretch and get some water. Lynn worked the zipper up over his chest to his chin, hesitated, then kissed the pads of her fingers and touched his forehead, the same way he'd seen countless loved ones and priests bless the dead. May your steps rise to the heavens, she whispered. Her wan smile caught in the spill of Joel's flashlight before the bag was sealed up over Mission's face. Or at least until upper dispatch, Joel added. They carried him outside and down the hall, and the porters made way for the dead. Several hands reached out and touched Mission through the black plastic, showing respect, and he fought not to flinch or cough. It felt as though the smoke was trapped in the bag with him. Joel took the lead, which meant Mission's shoulders were pressed against his. He faced upward, his body swaying in time to their steps, the straps beneath his armpits pulling the opposite way from what he was used to. It grew more comfortable as they hit the stairs and began the long spiral up. His feet were lowered until the blood no longer pooled in his head. Lynn carried her half of the weight from several steps below. The dark and quiet overtook him as they left the chaos of lower dispatch. The two porters didn't talk as some tandems might. They saved their breath and kept their thoughts to themselves. Joel set an aggressive pace. Mission could sense it in the gentle swing of his body suspended above the steel treads. As the steps passed, the journey grew more and more uncomfortable. It wasn't the difficulty breathing, for he had been shadowed well to manage his lungs on a long climb. He could also handle the stuffiness from the plastic pressed against his face. Nor was it the dark, for his favorite hour for porting had always been the dim time, time alone with his thoughts while others slept. It wasn't the stench of plastic and smoke, the tickle in his throat, or the pain of the straps. It was the act of lying still, of being carried, of being a burden. The straps pinched his shoulders until his arms fell numb, and he swayed in the darkness. The sounds of boots on steel, of Joel and Lynn's heavy breathing, as he was lifted up the stairwell. Too great a burden, he thought. He thought of his mother carrying him for all those months with no one to confide in and no one to support her. Not until his father had found out, and by then it was too late to terminate the pregnancy. He wondered how long his father had hated the bulge in her belly, how long he had wanted to cut Mission out like some kind of cancer. Mission had never asked to be carried like that, and he had never wanted to be ported by anyone ever again. 2 years ago to the day. That was the last time he had felt this sense of being a burden to all. 2 years since he had proved too much for even a rope to bear. It was a poor knot he had tied, but his hands had been trembling, and he had fought to see the knot through a film of tears. When it failed, the knot didn't come free so much as slide, and it left his neck afire and bleeding. His great regret was having jumped from the lower stairwell in mechanical, the rope looped over the pipes above. If he had gone from a landing, the slipping knot wouldn't have mattered. The fall would have claimed him. Now he was too scared to try again. He was as scared of trying again as he was of being a burden to another. Was that why he avoided seeing Allie? Because she longed to care for him, to help support him? Was that why he ran away from home? The tears finally came. His arms were pinned, so he couldn't wipe them away. He thought of his mother, about whom he could only piece together a few details. But he knew this of her. She hadn't been afraid of life or death. She'd embraced both in an act of sacrifice, giving her own blood for his, a trade he would never feel worthy of. The silos spun slowly around him. The steps sank one at a time, and Mission endured the suffering. He labored not to sob, seeing himself for the first time in that utter darkness, knowing his soul more fully in that deathly ritual of being ported to his grave, this sad awakening on his birthday. Silo 1. Chapter 50. Finding one among 10,000 should have been more difficult. It should have taken months of crawling through reports and databases, of querying the head of 18 and asking for personality profiles, of looking at arrest histories, cleaning schedules, who was related to whom, and all the gossip and chatter compiled from monthly reports. But Donald found an easier way. He simply searched the database for a facsimile of himself. One who remembered. One full of fear and paranoia. One who tries to blend in, but is subversive. He looked for a fear of doctors, teasing out those residents who never went to see them. He looked for someone who shunned medication and found one who did not even trust the water. A part of him expected he might find several people to be causing so much havoc. A pack, and that locating one among them would lead to the rest. He expected to find them young and outraged with some way of handing down what they knew from generation to generation. What he found instead was both eerily similar and not like him at all. The next morning he showed his results to Thurman, who stood perfectly still for a long while. Of course, he finally said. Of course. A hand on Donald's shoulder was all the congratulations he got. Thurman explained that the reset was well underway. He admitted that it had been underway since Donald had been woken and that the head of 18 had taken on new recruits, had sown the seeds of discord. Erskine and Dr. Sneed were working through the night to make changes, to come up with a new formulation, but this component might take weeks. Looking over what Donald had found, he said he was going to make a call to 18. I want to come with you, Donald said. It's my theory, after all. What he wanted to say was that he wouldn't take the coward's way. If someone was to be executed on his account, one life for the sake of many, he didn't want to hide from the decision. Thurman agreed. They rode the lift almost as equals. Donald asked why Thurman had started the reset, but he thought he knew the answer.
Vic won,
was Thurman's reply. Donald thought of all the lives in the database that were now thrown into chaos. He made the mistake of asking how the reset was going, and Thurman told him about the bombs and the violence, how the groups who wore different colors were warring with one another, how these things typically went downhill fast with the barest of nudges, that the formula was as old as time.
The combustibles are always there, Thurman said. You'd be surprised how few sparks it takes.
They exited the lift and walked down a familiar hallway. This was Donald's old commute. Here he had worked under a different name. He had worked without knowing what he was doing. They passed offices full of people tapping on keyboards and chatting with one another. Half a millennium of people, coming on and off shifts, doing what they were told, following orders. He couldn't help himself as they approached his old office. He paused at the door and peered in. A thin man with a halo of hair that wrapped from ear to ear, just a few wisps on top, looked up at him. He sat there, mouth agape, hand resting on his mouse, waiting for Donald to say or do something. Donald nodded a sympathetic hello. He turned and looked through the door across the hall where a man in white sat behind a similar desk. The puppeteer. Thurman spoke to him, and he got up from his desk and joined them in the hall. He knew that Thurman was in charge. Donald followed the two of them to the comm room, leaving the balding man at his old desk to his game of solitaire. He felt a mix of sympathy and envy for the man, for those who didn't remember. As they turned the corner, Donald thought back to those initial bouts of awareness on his first shift. He remembered speaking with a doctor who knew the truth, and having this sense of wonder that anyone could cope with such knowledge. And now he saw that it wasn't that the pain grew tolerable or the confusion went away. Instead, it simply became familiar. It became a part of you. The comm room was quiet. Heads swiveled as the three of them entered. One of the operators, in orange, hurriedly removed his feet from his desk. Another took a bite of his protein bar and turned back to his station.
Get me 18. Thurman said.
Eyes turned to the other man in white, the one supposedly in charge, and he waved his consent. A call was patched through. Thurman held half a headset to one ear while he waited. He caught the expression on Donald's face and asked the operator for another set. Donald stepped forward and took it while the cable was slotted into the receiver. He could hear the familiar beeping of a call being placed, and his stomach fluttered as doubts began to surface. Finally, a voice answered. A shadow. Thurman asked him to get Mr. Wick, the silo head. He's already coming, the shadow said. When Wick joined the conversation, Thurman told the head what Donald had discovered. But it was the shadow who responded. The shadow knew the one they were after. He said he knew the person well. There was something in his voice, some shock or hesitation, and Thurman waved at the operator to get the sensors in his headset going. Suddenly, the monitors were providing feedback like a rite of initiation. Thurman conducted the questioning, and Donald watched a master at work.
Tell me what you know, he said.
Thurman leaned over the operator and peered at a screen that monitored skin conductivity, pulse, and perspiration. Donald was no expert at reading the charts, but he knew something was up by the way the line spiked up and down when the shadow spoke. He feared for the young man. He wondered if someone would die then and there. But Thurman took a softer approach. He got the boy speaking of his childhood, had him admitting to the rage he harbored, a sense of not belonging. The shadow spoke of an upbringing both ideal and frustrating, and Thurman was like a gentle but firm drill sergeant working with a troubled recruit, tearing him down, building him back up.
"You've been fed the truth," he told the young man, referring to the legacy. "And now you see why the truth must be divvied out carefully, or not at all."
"I do."
The shadow sniffed as though he were crying, and yet the jagged lines on the screen informed less precipitously.